Hello, everyone, and welcome to the fourth season of McGill Care's webcast series supporting family and informal care partners. I'm Claire Webster, a former caregiver, certified dementia care consultant, and founder of McGill University's Dementia Education Program. I work with a dynamic team of leading healthcare professionals to oversee the program, who include Dr. José Moret from the Division of Geriatric Medicine, and Dr. Serge Gauthier, Professor Emeritus, formerly of the McGill University Research Center for Studies in Aging. McGill Cares is supported by the Amelia Saputo Community Outreach for Dementia Care. The McGill Dementia Education Program offers a comprehensive range of free resources to educate and support persons living with dementia, family and informal care partners, healthcare professionals, medical students, and the public at large. One of our most important resources is the Dementia Companion Guide, which can either be downloaded for free. It is available in 10 different languages, and printed copies can be purchased on Amazon. All proceeds go to support our program. We also have an extensive library of past McGill Cares webcasts, as well as various resources and virtual support groups that anyone can access for free. So please visit our website at mcgill.ca/dementia. So in honor of World Alzheimer's Month, we have a very special topic today, which is an update on new medications to treat Alzheimer's disease. And no one better to discuss this topic than my colleague, Dr. Serge Gauthier. Dr. Gauthier is a clinical neurologist specializing in the development of new tools for diagnosis and treatments for people living with Alzheimer's disease. He was the director of the McGill University Research Center for Studies in Aging from 1986 to 1997. Dr. Gauthier is the academic co-lead for the Dementia Education Program and Professor Emeritus, Neurology and Psychiatry at McGill University. His great accomplishments led him to being appointed to the Order of Canada in 2014 and the National Order of Quebec in 2017. Welcome to McGill Cares, Dr. Gauthier.
Good to see you and the audience.
So there's been a lot of news in the media lately regarding certain drugs that are offering hope for people who have Alzheimer's disease or other forms of dementia. And, you know, I thought that it would be very important to bring you on to really maybe dispel some myths or really clarify the role that these drugs play, because, you know, many people are now wondering, how can I have access to the drugs? You know, at what stage can the person, will the drug have an impact? So I thought that we can have a really good discussion and put some truth and validity behind all of this. So to begin, maybe you can discuss, because the question that comes up all the time is, what's the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia?
It's always the first question, and a very good one indeed, because dementia is now considered a stage, a late stage of Alzheimer's disease. Another way to answer is dementia is a syndrome, a number of symptoms. Memory is only one of them. Memory lapses is only one of the symptoms. And what's more important for the discussion today is that dementia is a late stage of Alzheimer's disease, which can be diagnosed now before dementia.
Okay. So is there currently a cure for Alzheimer's disease or dementia?
No, there's no cure, but there's a lot of treatments, both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic. And today the discussion will be mostly about the new generation of medications for Alzheimer's disease at a certain stage of the course of disease.
So when the media speaks about a potential drug that may offer hope, is this for all types of dementia?
A very important point to clarify, because Alzheimer's disease is the best known cause of dementia, but it's only one of many. And the older you are, like over age 85, the more it's a mix of causes. And the new medications we'll talk about are not for people over age 85, because they have a mix of Alzheimer's disease related changes in the brain, plus small strokes, plus a bit of Parkinson related changes, plus other proteins that seem to build up in certain parts of the brain that have to do with memory.
So I want to go back to maybe the first question about, you know, the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So dementia, you know, oftentimes we see this umbrella that says dementia. And then underneath dementia, there are different types of illnesses that cause dementia, right? So there's Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, Lewy body, frontal temporal. So when we're talking about these drugs, because I know working with some families who have received diagnosis, for example, of Lewy body dementia, these drugs, do they work also for those types of dementias? Or are we talking only now, like all the scientists that are working in their labs, is this only specifically for Alzheimer's disease?
So the current drugs we'll talk about today are specific to Alzheimer's disease. That being said, persons who have a diagnosis of dementia with Lewy bodies may have also Alzheimer's disease mixed together. Mm-hmm. And there's been no formal testing yet of someone who has a dementia at a very mild stage, mostly Lewy body. But if they also have Alzheimer's disease pathology, potentially these drugs will be useful for them. We don't know yet.
So how could people find out exactly what type of dementia they have?
This is such a good question. We've been working on this for years. And the Center for Studies in Aging, now with the leadership of Dr. Rosa Neto, has broke new grounds with blood tests. To make a long story short, we have volunteers out of the greater region of Montreal. Every year they have scans of the brain, spinal taps, and blood tests. And this is these biomarkers, scans, spinal fluid, and blood, have allowed us now to refine the diagnosis of the cause of mild symptoms, not yet dementia, or mild dementia, very accurately. And now the rest of the world is going to benefit from this research with biomarkers, mostly the blood as a first step, and then a spinal tap or a brain scan.
So most people don't have access to this type of comprehensive range of tests, right? So the average person that is seeing a family doctor and is going to have the MoCA or the mini mental test, could that be specific in terms of determining exactly what type of dementia, or do you have to go through the blood test and the spinal tap and an MRI?
So you need extra tests. The tests you mentioned are paper and pencil tests, the MoCA and the mini mental state exam or Fullstein. These are screening tools for cognitive impairment. There's a whole complex workup, which we've discussed before together. But to have the specific cause of the symptoms, you need the blood as a screening tool and then spinal tap or scan of the brain. Mm-hmm. This will be available more and more. And this is one positive outcome of all this research with the new medications. We now have to make a more accurate diagnosis of the cause of symptoms, and the earlier, the better.
So that's what I was going to say now. This states how important it is for people to really find out what type of dementia they have in order to know whether or not they would qualify for the drugs, right? Because for somebody that would be diagnosed, for example, with Lewy body dementia or a frontal temporal, it would mean that right now the drugs that are out there in the market wouldn't necessarily work for their type of dementia.
That is correct. Okay. I must qualify what you said about to dementia. We're going to make the diagnosis before dementia more and more. So there's a window of 3 to 5 years of mild symptoms before dementia. And that's also the big shift in the diagnostic approach that will be promoted now across Canada and the rest of the world. Take seriously complaints about memory or looking for words or looking for your way around with your car, even if they don't interfere with daily life in a significant way. So not dementia yet. People should be worked up if they wish for the cause of the mild symptoms. And if it is Alzheimer's at a very mild stage, they would be perhaps the best people to get the new treatments.
So when you're saying you're looking for type of symptoms 3 to 5 years, it's interesting because, you know, when I work with families, they say, oh, now I look back and go, you know, they began with these conspiracy theories, or they were making these unusual type of investments, or So we're not only looking for memory issues, right? Like we're looking for significant changes in personality perhaps as well.
It could be many things, as you quite rightly point out. It's rarely just lapses in memory, which are often normal, and we compensate with post-its and other tricks. Mm-hmm. But indeed, if it's affecting your judgment for financial affairs, it's affecting your personality, you're perhaps showing social withdrawal, or more anxiety, mild depression. It should be looked after, not just because there's new drugs, it's just because there's many things we can do for you.
Okay. So what are the names of the current drugs that are being mentioned that, you know, we hear on all the CNN and CTV? Like, what would be some of those names that we're hearing?
Just two names. Okay. Lecanemab and donanemab.
So how do they work?
So they're antibodies made against the protein that builds up in your brain with age called beta 42. Amyloid beta 42 is a fragment of a larger protein. And with age, all of us, it just sticks in the brain. It's not cleared, washed away while you're sleeping, as it usually does. It's not sufficient to cause symptoms. You need something else. And we're working on what's the second step. Many of us think it's neuroinflammation. And maybe that's why people who take medicines for arthritis, they have a much reduced risk of Alzheimer's because they take some medicine against neuroinflammation while they're treating their aches and pains and joints and other parts of the body. The other factor at play is another protein called tau. Tau is a structural protein within nerve cells. And with age, in certain parts of the brain that have to do with memory, it tends to clump into tangles. We can see that now with the PET scans. But it could also spread from cell to cell and all over the brain. And that's when you get real symptoms of dementia. Ideally, we should find out if you have the amyloid buildup and early start of the tau protein spreading. That's the best time to treat people with the new medicines.
So one of the challenges that we know exists with dementia is the term anosognosia, right? So many people who are displaying those symptoms are in denial that there's anything wrong with them. So how do we get those people, like as a family member, I start noticing changes in my mother, my husband, my wife. How do I convince them to see a doctor? Because I mean, that's where we want to get them, right? We want to get them in the early stages, but what if the person themselves doesn't think there's anything wrong with them?
Well, you cannot force people to go to the doctor if they really don't want to, but the availability of blood tests and specific tests for a diagnosis of their mild symptoms may be a convincing argument, and an early treatment may be also a game changer in this resistance to see a doctor early on. But you're right, it's specific to Alzheimer's, this lack of awareness, anosognosia, it's a component of the disease. We've talked about this before, and there are ways around it, such as we suggest to the older couple, come together, you're getting a checkup together. Mm-hmm. There are ways around that to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think maybe also encouraging people about the importance of having an annual physical checkup, right? You're going to see the doctor for your annual physical checkup. You want to have, you know, your heart health, your brain health. So it's important, I think, just to maybe get into a routine of doing that. Okay, so these drugs, how are they administered?
It's intravenous for these two drugs. One of them is twice a month. The other is once a month. So it's about an hour-long infusion. For people to get a feel for what it's like, it's a bit like chemotherapy. You get tested. We find that you're a candidate for that treatment. It will work best at a very specific stage of disease. You will get a year of treatment. The studies were 1 year and a half duration, but probably 1 year is sufficient. The antibodies are given intravenously, about 3% get in the blood, gets into the brain, but it's sufficient to clear the amyloid buildup over a year.
Okay, so let's be clear. These are intravenous drugs. These are not pills.
Correct.
These are drugs given intravenously. Okay, so who has access to them and how could people have access? I mean, is this available in Canada? Is it only available right now in the US, Europe? Like, who has access to this?
So these two drugs are approved only in the US, and they're still negotiating the reimbursement in the US for that. Their use, even in the US, is going to be limited to specialized sites where they did the testing for these drugs under careful supervision. They're starting in the US to publish appropriate use recommendations, sort of clinical guidelines, which we're following closely. And in Canada and Quebec in particular, because we have access to all the diagnostic equipment. And I think we have a good chance to have the infusion sites in the hospitals and private clinics and at home. We're getting ready, assuming that it will be approved in Canada. One or the two will be approved in Canada at the end of next year.
So yeah, just thinking about that. So you're talking about infusion sites. This is not just a person who's going to see their doctor and gets a prescription. This is much more complex than that. Because when you say it's similar to chemotherapy, I imagine people have to go and you need, you know, rooms set up and you need chairs and it's, and so is there a cost like right now? I mean, obviously it's just all offered in the States, but it must be quite expensive.
Probably the state, each state, because it's state by state, will pay 75% of the cost, which is in the order of $26,000 US per year, which is not far from some of the chemotherapy costs, by the way. And if you're interested in another comparison with chemotherapy, where you gain months of life or months in remission, it would be a similar concept for persons who have such mild symptoms that we delay by 4 to 7 months progression to the next stage of Alzheimer's. So it's a way to understand the treatment. You don't improve the symptoms you have, but you delay progression by months into the next stage, which would be possibly mild dementia if you start at a very mild forgetful stage. Or if you have mild dementia, you delay by months progression to moderate dementia.
Okay, so let's make sure that people understand this. So it is not a cure, but it is more a treatment to delay the progression of the disease.
Correct.
Okay.
That's what it was designed for. Okay. And in theory, it would have stabilized progression, like flat line. If you take the amyloid out of the brain, if it was the only cause of symptoms, you would have a perfect stable progression for years. Of course, it's not perfect line. It is a change in curve because we are not treating other parts of the puzzle. The tau protein buildup, we're not interfering with that, with the current drugs. And we're not changing the inflammation in the brain. And we're not changing small stroke. So we have to continue treating the person as a whole, whether they get the new drugs or not.
Okay. So at what stage? So that's the, so what, at what stage? Like when would somebody be eligible to start taking these drugs? I mean, obviously they would have to have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, but at what point?
The key message for today. It's a very narrow range. It's the 3 years before dementia when you have mild symptoms. And the first 2 years of dementia, where the symptoms are mild enough that with a little bit of help, especially for finances and planning an outing and making sure you take your pills on time, that's it. So you got a 5 year window in a disease course of about 15 years. It's still a good chunk of time, but we need to have a diagnosis within that 5 years. And that's going to be the challenge, getting to the right doctor and clinic to get the treatment early enough that it really matters.
So what are some of the risk factors and side effects that have been seen with these drugs so far?
Important question indeed, because these injections go through the blood vessels into the brain, and the amyloid is also present in the blood vessels. And when you clear the amyloid out of the blood vessels, it makes them leaky. So there's about 25% risk of swelling of the brain, which most of the time is silent. You're not aware of it. You just see it on the scans, the MRI, magnetic resonance imaging scan, that we have to do 5 times during the year of treatment. There's also a risk of small bleeding. It could be microscopic bleed. You barely see it, or it could be a big bleed and you get like a stroke. And that's about another 18-20% risk of small bleeds, and maybe 1% risk of big bleeds with complications. So it's not holy water. You need to monitor over the year of treatment with MRIs. So you need access to the MRIs. And if you have any symptoms that could be related to this complication, like headaches, dizziness, anything that looks like a mild stroke, you need a scan right away. And then you have to be managed possibly in a hospital setting. So this will be an issue for people who live far away from the infusion site. They need access to an MRI if they have symptoms. They need access to a hospital, maybe an ICU. So you see, we'll have to learn together how to use that new generation of medicines. The good news is a year later, after their approval, there'll be an oral drug that will do probably as well to get the amyloid out of the brain without this risk of brain swelling and bleeding. And more to say about that when the testing for the oral drug is available next year.
So right now, this drug, in its current stage, is it available to the general public in the US, or is it still in like clinical trial? Like, is it?
It's available to the general public in the US, but under appropriate use recommendations that are so tight. You need hospital access. You need an MRI access. There's very few doctors who will actually use them, even if they were free to use. Okay? It's the same here. Even if they were under Medicare completely free, you need access to all the support resources. So it's an important step. It shows that amyloid, you can actually clear it out of the brain. You actually modify disease progression. We can measure it. It's not a flat line. So in an ideal world, we'll have an anti-tau drug in 2 years to add to this treatment, or in sequence, year of amyloid therapy, oral, easier than IV, and then anti-tau therapy, oral or IV. And anti-inflammation, we don't know yet. We're working on this in parallel.
Okay, so if I'm a viewer and I'm watching McGill Cares from the United States, and I have a family member that I feel could be eligible, what do I do? Do I go up to my family doctor, to my neurologist, my geriatrician, and say, I would like to have access to this drug? Like, how does it work? Like, how do people have access?
Like, well, I don't know about the American approach, but they will likely call the neurologist, if they know one, mm-hmm. who will likely refer them to the infusion site within their state. It will be the same in Quebec and Canada. You'll have specialized sites that maybe have a satellite diagnostic facilities. This is something we hope to create with the Groupe de Médecine Familiale in Quebec and the MINT, the Ontario style mm-hmm. clinics, where you have a group of family doctors and specialists if required, and nurses to keep track of how people are doing. This is another thing. Even if you don't get the new drug, it's going to change not just the diagnosis with biomarkers, but also the prise en charge, the management. It's going to become a chronic illness like arthritis and some types of cancers, where you'll need a nurse that you can call or write to, because it's going to be a 15-year illness instead of the current 5. Because now it's diagnosed late and you die of complications. It's going to be changing the complete picture. And hopefully young doctors will be now excited, make an early diagnosis before dementia. We actually keep people in this mild stage for months, possibly years, if we combine amyloid and tau medicines. It's a game changer.
So there's so many pharmaceutical companies that are trying to find the right drug, right? And for years and years, like, we've been waiting, and sometimes the drugs fail. So how does a drug go from the science lab into becoming approved and administered to patients? What makes one drug better than the other?
Yeah. It's very difficult in the field of Alzheimer's. There's only 1 or 2% of the drugs being discovered in the lab and then in animals that make it to the market. It's very expensive for the drug companies. So that's why they have to recoup their costs as soon as possible while their patent is still valid. But the enthusiasm in the drug industry, especially in the US, is good for the field, because the fact that there's new medicines, even if they're not easy to get at, will accelerate development of diagnostic tests. There's possibly also means to do at a distance an assessment online. It's a topic for another day, but we hope we learned that through the pandemic. There may be ways to do a screening online with the MoCA, for instance, and other checklists. And then if it's the blood test that is the next stage for ApoE and the new blood biomarker specific to amyloid and tau, okay, maybe the blood can be sent by mail to a site and so on. So we're going to get smarter at this, especially for a country with such a geographic spread as we have in Canada. Distance screening, a local clinic where you have a group of people to make a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment or dementia, and a first step towards it cause, what's the cause? And then you refer quickly to an infusion site or other treatment sites. The new pills, when they come for amyloid in 2 years or 3 years, okay, you'll need to monitor also how people are doing. So maybe once a year, you'll have a physical and cognitive and functional assessment and so on. There's going to be more, that's also a breakthrough, more interaction between the clinical trial sites, the very specialized sites, and the local sites, including hopefully some of the rural or smaller city regions.
So what's the current status of the drugs being approved in Canada by Health Canada? Right now, it's the FDA has approved it, but where are we in terms of it being approved in Canada?
Okay, so the two drugs we were discussing, lecanemab and donanemab, they are being submitted to Health Canada. It takes at least a year for them to review the information. They have the option at Health Canada to make it a priority review, saving some months or not. During that year, it gives us time to plan. How would we use them once they're out? We need that year to plan. It's already in the works. There'll be opportunities in Toronto later this fall to discuss with the help of Jeff Cummings, the leader of the U.S. approach, appropriate use recommendations. We're going to write our own in Canada and in Quebec. We're getting ready. While we're doing that, there's still testing ongoing for the oral equivalent and anti-tau drugs. We'll have news about that also later this year. So there's a convergence of things happening. So I hope people don't get fixated. I want this intravenous drug. There's much more coming and happening. And we'll see in a year when the dust settles and we're ready to go, there will be interest in the public to go for an infusion every month for a year and get five MRI scans, and it's involved. So my prediction is the people who are younger, like 60 to 75, who are milder in their symptoms, will be the ones most motivated.
So you're so involved in this field, like, you know, you travel the world and you're so involved. What is your prediction in terms of when, like, when will an oral a pill be available? Like, when would you realistically see that we have a really good setup in terms of whether it be infusion sites or satellite sites where people are really being treated for this illness? Like, how long before that happens?
End of next year for the infusions starting, and the oral will be the year after. During that time of sort of wait, people can join clinical trial sites. For instance, at the Center for Studies in Aging, in partnership with the Montreal Neuro, we're now using one of the two drugs for people who have Alzheimer's, familial Alzheimer's, inherited. So they tend to be younger, like 40 to 45. So they're getting the drug under very careful supervision. And in Quebec City, Dr. Louis Verrette also has an open label. People who were part of those studies that led to the approval in the U.S., they're still getting the drug. So there's more information being collected. And there were patients in Canada in those studies, which were performed worldwide. So I didn't quite fully answer your question about the steps in the development. So from the lab to the animal models, you need at least two, usually rats and monkeys. Then you go to man. First in man is usually to make sure the drug is safe. So you give a little bit. It could be healthy volunteers, young or old. And then you try it higher doses progressively under very careful supervision. Then you go in phase two, where you have around 100 people. Half of them get the drug, half of them get a placebo. And phase three is what led to the approval. It's 1,000 people, half of them getting the drug, half of them not, during the duration of study. What has been the delay to get that class of drug approved is people were not getting enough antibodies. People were afraid to give too much. And now we know you need to give enough to clear the amyloid out of the brain. The antibodies, that's the difference between the drugs. Some of them are more specific to the plaques, the clumps of amyloid fibrils. Other antibodies are more the free-floating amyloid. And time will tell if one is better than the other at a certain stage of disease.
Okay, one last very important question. In the meantime, what can people do to reduce the risk of developing dementia?
Many things. And that's the topic of this year's World Alzheimer's Report 2023, Prevention Strategies. It's written by a very competent journalist, so it should be out by the time this interview is aired. There are 11 modifiable risk factors that we can all work on, all of us, right away, starting from being more active physically. So the risk factor is being inactive. I just listed them to be sure I don't forget anything important. So diabetes, yes. If you have treated well, if you have high blood pressure, treated well, sooner the better. Social isolation is now recognized as a factor. So it's better to join a book club rather than just read alone. Even if you go alone to see a play or a movie, talk to your friends or the guy next seat and exchange, talk about it. Low education is a big factor. That's mostly at the societal level. We're doing okay in Canada compared to rural parts of China, for instance, but it's never too late to go back to school, learn a second or third language. We're good at that in Quebec. Depression, if you have, treat it well. Hearing impairment, big factor that is easily treatable. And here, of course, visual impairment, which makes sense. So lots of things. This will be the topic for the World Alzheimer's Report. So I hope people will access it. We'll certainly put the link on our...
on our website.
In the website.
Dr. Gauthier, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. It's always wonderful to have an interview with you. You're always so engaging. So thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So this webcast is an initiative of the McGill University Dementia Education Program, which is funded by private donations. If you would like to make a contribution to our program or for more information, please visit us at mcgill.ca/dementia. And if you would like to join our mailing list to be notified about upcoming episodes of McGill Cares, as well as other important programs and resources from us, you can email us at dementia@mcgill.ca or sign up at our website. Thank you for watching.